Sup, you beautiful bastards. You're watching the Philip DeFranco Show, and we got a lot of news to talk about today. We've got Moist Critical and TikTok suing the United States. There was a shooting at Drake's house amid this wild beef with Kendrick Lamar. New Mr. Beast news exposes a growing trend. We break down the global glasses crisis. And we look into what now after Israeli forces seize the Gaza side of the key Rafah border crossing. And then there's even more we got to talk about today, so just buckle up, hit that like button to let YouTube know you like these big daily dives into the news, and let's jump into it.
Starting with...
In really troubling news that a lot of people are like celebrating or even memeing about, police say that a security guard's been seriously injured in a shooting outside of Drake's home in Toronto, right? And reportedly it happened around 2 a.m. Officials saying it's unclear if Drake was actually home while it happened, though his team is reportedly cooperating with the investigation and the security guard that was shot is currently at the hospital where he received surgery. But as far as the suspect or suspects, they fled the scene in a vehicle, and while the shooting was caught on video, police have not offered descriptions of them or the car yet. And as far as what the hell happened, why did this happen? You're the inspector of the Integrated Gun and Gang Task Force telling news outlets this morning.
I cannot speak to a motive at this time because it's so early, but as we get information, we will share it with you.
Right, so currently, that remains a very big question mark. But of course, you have a lot of people noting that this is all happening amid a heated feud between Drake and Kendrick Lamar. And while no official motive has been announced, you have a lot of people pointing fingers. Right, noting things like the cover art for Kendrick's song Not Like Us shows an aerial shot of Drake's Toronto home, including the name of the street that he's on. You know, with that photo specifically including markers meant to show sex offenders at the home because the song notably accuses Drake and members of his teams of being pedophiles. And so what we've seen with a lot of this discourse is people believing that it's connected to the beef and some seemingly excited that this is happening. With some saying things like real rap beef is so back. But of course this is others are just freaked out that people are celebrating this. Writing things like, okay, this is actually starting to get a little too Biggie and Pac now. Let's chill the fuck out. People saying this is getting exciting are the ones to tweet RIP when something happens. You guys have literally learned nothing from history. Some also concerned that Kendrick potentially incited this by sharing the image of Drake's home. But again, it just bears repeating, police at this point have not said that this is related to their conflict either way. Right, currently you have a lot of different people jumping to a lot of different conclusions like they're at a trampoline park. But obviously this is a developing situation, and when we get more details and confirmations, I'll let you know. Though also, just so you don't think I have my head in the sand, like, it really would not surprise me if this was connected. Wild accusations, wild threats have been thrown out in all this. You have hardcore fandoms, tens of millions of people are a part of it. And in any situation, all it takes is one person to pull a trigger. But it's important that we wait till all the facts come out so we get a clear picture on this. And then, in really big and interesting behind-the-scenes online entertainment news, Mr. Beast is reportedly breaking away from his management company, Knight Media, with reports saying that Knight will no longer be his primary talent management agency, and adding that this move shows the growing power creators are getting in the entertainment industry. And you may not realize it, but this is a huge switch. I mean, Jimmy's been working with Reed Duckshore, the founder of Knight, since 2018, right back when he was getting between 450 million to 2 billion views a year, whereas today he's this powerhouse that brought in 32 billion views in the last year. But all of this is according to Semaphore, things started to cool down in their relationship, with them saying one of the biggest issues is that Reed didn't want to move from Texas to North Carolina, where Mr. Beast is headquartered. And while Knight does have other big clients, Mr. Beast was by far the biggest. So this can be seen as a big loss for them, though, according to Bloomberg, Reed will still work with Mr. Beast on the Feastables snack brand, with Mr. Beast also giving a statement to the outlet saying, as the company develops and our needs change, he and I continue to have a great relationship. At this point, it makes sense to put full focus into the growth of Feastables and for me to start building my own internal team. And Bloomberg confirming that even after this split, he's not going to be tying himself to representation from a traditional talent agency. Though I will say, while this is big news, it's not completely shocking. Or Mr. Beast is in no way the first major creator to decide to just do things on his own terms. You know, you see examples like the D'Amelio family running a big enterprise, with their agent at the time even leaving the firm UTA to become the president of their multi-million dollar organization. But also, I will say what I found most interesting about the reporting around this situation is that you had places like Semaphore closing their piece saying that Mr. Beast's choice, it's also a risk as Donaldson seeks to break away from the infrastructure of a new industry, saying Donaldson plans to work with a range of talent agencies on a non-exclusive basis, but some firms are privately reluctant to work with the creator who has a reputation for being a tough client, which had the drama lover in me going, ooh, tell me more. Though I will say, I can't imagine what it is to operate at that level for such an extended period of time, right? I view my job, I view content creation in general as this marathon once you break into it. But seemingly, everything Mr. Beast is like, they are running a marathon, but they're like the Kenyan runner that's winning the marathon, right? Where you're just like watching in awe, like, did you just sprint a marathon? But then also they go to sleep, wake up, and do it again. Right, they're producing YouTube videos at scales I've never seen before. They have the massive Feastables business. They also just inked that Amazon Prime Video deal. Like, it's all exciting things, but I'm just tired at the thought of having to do any of it. But that also speaks to how make or break finding and building the right team is going to be here. And so as far as if this is going to be the right move, Time will tell.
And then
YouTuber Moist Critical is suing U.S. Immigration, though it doesn't have to do with YouTube. Because while he didn't say specifically what offices, he said that immigration allegedly made it nearly impossible for three Australian members of his esports organization's Apex Legends team to get into the United States. Right at first, they were flat out denied entry for one tournament, with Moist saying he didn't understand why.
One of the reasons they gave us was they didn't believe they were as highly ranked as we stated they were, even though we gave them all of the leaderboards, the official standings, and they could also just Google that if they didn't believe us.
They even had an EA official vouch for them, but that didn't work either.
It prevented our team from coming into the country, which upended our entire plans of having them here for the split one.
Now, thankfully, Moy says they were able to compete in Canada, where they qualified for a major tournament that recently took place in LA. But since the team members were denied entry so many times, they couldn't make it to LA together. And so Moy decided to take an L and release the team. But because these players had no chance of entry under Moy Esports' umbrella, they had to try on their own. But even that was a whole ordeal, because two out of the three Australian players were denied ESTA visas, which are notably supposed to be relatively easy to get.
Why were two of them rejected, but MT's was accepted? They were in the same boat, and yet for some reason, it was him that was okay, but the other two, no, they're danger.
And so for the other two, they had to go through this whole long process of getting in-person interviews, which involved them flying from Canada to Lisbon, then Lisbon to LA, and they only landed in the US with very little time before the tournament to prepare with the rest of the group, where despite all these headaches, despite the odds, the team ended up competing well. Though notably, they weren't able to play as Moist Esports. They ended up having to play as Not Moist.
I couldn't be more proud of this group of gentlemen, of which I am not associated with on any paperwork whatsoever. They are not our team. They literally are not our team, but I am still very proud of this group.
But, you know, still with all this, he claimed that U.S. immigration put them through unnecessary and potentially illegal obstacles to get to this point, with his lawyers agreeing that this process was mysterious, leading to the decision to sue.
It seems like there were quite a few no-nos that were committed here, and some protocol that wasn't followed, and a lot of just big red flags, like some big problems. And it just really seems like the U.S. immigration agent handling our case either didn't like us, or just really didn't feel like doing their job.
He even went as far as to claim that this whole system, the Constitution itself, is corrupt, saying that even if they win their case, they won't be paid out any damages, even though this is such an expensive process and there is lost income. Right, the best that'll happen is the decision is overturned. And Moist, you know, saying himself that suing over matters like this, it's not uncommon. In fact, if you look into it, in recent years, we've seen a number of athletes at the professional and college levels having these problems. And while there are a few one-to-one examples that align with Moist's situation exactly, it does show that it is a much larger issue than just this one incident. For example, back in 2020, the Buffalo Sabres hockey team sued federal immigration officials after a green card for their trainer was rejected, where the team there was sponsoring a doctor from the UK for permanent residency, with them specifically seeking a visa for applicants who show that they're exceptional in their fields of work. And so he had lawyers showing his peer-reviewed research, some of which is actually used by the NBA and NFL, but officials denied him. And there we saw the Sabres saying immigration services failed to follow their own rules, and with that saying it caused them financial harm and disruption in caring for its athletes. But there, immigration officials eventually reversed course, prompting the team to drop the lawsuit. And also a key thing is that Moy's story comes at a time when the Supreme Court is actually weighing a case regarding visas, with that centering around a woman who said that the government violated her constitutional right to marriage when they denied her Salvadoran husband a visa partially because of his tattoos, with the government believing that he was a gang member based on his tattoos and background check. And while he denied the tattoos were gang-affiliated and a court-approved expert agreed, the federal government claimed that it didn't violate the right to marriage because the couple could live together outside of the U.S. And this is according to the LA Times. Right now it seems like the Supreme Court is skeptical about the couple's case. But it's important to see what happens there, because this is a big case with Bloomberg Law explaining. It raises what due process applicants are entitled to in cases of a visa denial, and noting that a decision could have ripple effects for other visa categories like employment-based visas. So while parts are far from the issues that Moy specifically had here, it is an important and hot topic right now. And in many ways, this speaks to his frustrations with how much power and impunity immigration offices have. That if you want to challenge these decisions that you either don't understand or you don't agree with, that it's going to come with a monstrous uphill battle.
And then
Charlie isn't the only person suing the U.S. today, because TikTok is now suing the U.S. government. With NBC News reporting that TikTok filed a lawsuit this morning in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and in that, arguing that the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, right, the one meant to make the Chinese owners sell the app or have it banned, that it violates constitutional protections of free speech. With TikTok claiming in the lawsuit, for the first time in history, Congress has enacted a law that subjects a single named speech platform to a permanent nationwide ban, and bars every American from participating in a unique online online community with more than 1 billion people worldwide. Now, as far as what this means for you, right, if you're someone that uses TikTok, the really big thing is that this changes the timeline. Right, because of this bill that was signed by Biden, ByteDance, which owns TikTok, they essentially had a year to figure things out. But by jumping into this lawsuit, no matter how it ends, at the very least, it extends the timeline probably years. That is a lot of time for creators to diversify where you post stuff and where your audiences exist. Kind of like how the majority of people watch my show on YouTube, but I pushed AffiliateD.TV and Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And again, that is separate from how the lawsuit itself will actually end. Right? Because as outlets like Axios have noted, TikTok says the government hasn't met the burden of proof required around its claims around the app's risk to data security. With the lawsuit reading, Congress itself has offered nothing to suggest that the TikTok platform poses the types of risks to data security or the spread of foreign propaganda that could conceivably justify the act. Right? Saying that at most, they have offered speculation, not evidence. But, you know, all of this is playing out as you have people like reportedly an associate clinical professor of law at Cornell University and an associate director of its First Amendment clinic saying TikTok has prevailed in its previous First Amendment challenges. But the bipartisan nature of this federal law may make judges more likely to defer to a congressional determination that the company poses a national security risk. But also adding, without public discussion of what exactly the risks are, however, it's difficult to determine why the court should validate such an unprecedented law. Right? And so the road is now laid in front of TikTok and the U.S. government, and it's going to be interesting to watch it play out. And then I'll get right back to the news. But first, I got to say, we did it. From K-pop to comedy, Timberlake to Broadway, EDC to stadium soccer. Our weekly SeatGeek $500 giveaway has sent beautiful bastards like you to all types of events over the last several months. Right? And for those new to the show, SeatGeek is the number one rated live event ticketing app with over 28 million downloads and access to a wide array of entertainment to get you and a loved one out of the house. And my team's worked with SeatGeek to extend our weekly giveaway. $500 in credit towards any of SeatGeek's 70,000 events continues here at the PDS, and entering honestly couldn't be easier. Simply add code PDS to your SeatGeek account and get $10 off, and you could be one of our lucky weekly winners. Also, if you're completely new to SeatGeek, you can also add code Phil for $20 off your first purchase. But again, even for SeatGeek vets, we got you covered. Code PDS gets you $10 off any purchase, and again, you'll be entered for your chance at a $500 SeatGeek credit, no purchase necessary. Also, if you're interested in a chance to win $1,000 of SeatGeek credit, Daily Dip newsletter subscribers can earn double entry and double winning. So just keep up with the PDS in your inbox and subscribe today. And then, yo, right now, we're seeing some absolutely wild international weather events play out. And all of this feels like it's becoming more and more common. I mean, just look at the massive flooding in Kenya and Brazil, or the severe drought in the Philippines. Right, over in Kenya, over 212,000 people have been displaced because of crazy rainfall and massive flooding near the capital, with part of that including deadly flash floods, which have killed at least 228 people and left 72 missing. While heavy rain in May is common in Kenya, in just the first 2 days of May, they've seen more than half a month's worth of rainfall. And experts believe that this has been caused by two weather patterns, El Nino and warmer waters making their way across the Indian Ocean, all of which is fueled by global warming. And while that's bad enough, the human response to the disaster has left many angered. Right? There's a general sentiment that not enough is being done by the Kenyan government to help with rescue efforts, or that it failed to prepare for the storms even though it had early warning signs. Now, that being said, some have defended them and pointed to the 115 refugee camps it set up and its plans to heavily expand that number. But things there may just get worse before they stand a chance of getting better, because the Interior Cabinet Ministry announced that 178 dams and reservoirs will likely spill over, with residents near them given 24 hours to get out or face being forcibly removed from their homes. Plus, on top of that, the flooding has not only destroyed homes, but also contaminated the water supply. And what's wild is that's almost the exact thing that's playing out over in Brazil. Right there, over half of its states are dealing with flooding, leading to more than 20,000 people being left homeless, and a major state being almost literally completely incapacitated. Right, in just about a week and a half, it was hit with about 3 months' worth of rain. Its infrastructure is almost completely underwater, and people need to get around in boats. And things there aren't expected to change for at least several weeks, and they could get even worse as more rainfall is expected. Plus, just to have a little cherry on top, temperatures there are expected to drop into the 50s. Well, that's not super cold. Normally, it is cold for Brazil, and because it's so wet right now, there's a high chance of hypothermia. So all of this is people worried that if things get much worse there, there could be a serious civil unrest as people struggle to get basic necessities like water. Which to some might sound ironic, but there is a massive difference between flood water and clean drinking water, or even what you would use to bathe. But then, if you travel across the globe, you can experience the exact opposite of the problem there. The Philippines not having nearly enough water as it's struggling with a huge drought. In fact, it's so bad that some dams and reservoirs have literally almost no water left. I mean, it's to a point that a town that was submerged in the 1970s to make way for a reservoir is once again on dry land. Now, that said, that has happened before, but what is notable is that this is by far the longest it has been like this since the dam was built. And while not having enough rainfall is bad enough, if you add in this ongoing heat wave and the humidity, there's a real recipe for disaster there, especially when you remember that things like air conditioners aren't exactly common for most households there. So this also means that across the country, millions have been affected as schools are are being shut down, office workers are being told to work from home as it's too dangerous to commute around. Right, and this is the heat waves not just in the Philippines, but across all of Southeast Asia, where they're seeing Bangladesh suspending classes for 33 million students. Over in Thailand, over 30 people have died of heat stroke just this year so far. And those last words are the biggest ones, so far. Especially as I doubt this is going to be the only record-breaking weather event we talk about this year.
And then,
what kind of present do you get Vladimir Putin? Right, how many of us have been in that position where we're like, ah, what do I get Vlad? He's so hard to buy for. Whatever he wants, he just gets for himself, or more specifically, he takes, whether it be power or land or life. So it might not be the most shocking thing to find out that with Vladimir Putin being inaugurated for his now fifth six-year term in a fancy celebration this morning, that his cronies wanted to make it an extra special celebration by gifting him Zelensky's assassination, as well as, you know, some others, but definitely Zelensky was the banana in the banana split. Right, and all of that, according to Ukrainian intelligence services, who have arrested two Ukrainian colonels and charged them with treason for allegedly working with the Russian FSB to set something up. And as far as the plan, it seems to involve using drones and explosives to target the Ukrainian officials, all of which were provided by the Russian FSB. Or in the case of Zelensky, one of the tasks of the FSB's agent network was to find perpetrators among the military close to the president's security who would take the head of state hostage and then kill him. Although with this, it should be mentioned that outside of some images that allegedly show the would-be assassins and their equipment, not much information was provided by the SBU. And notably, if this had been successful, it would have not only taken out Zelensky, but other key figures like the two leaders of Ukraine's biggest intelligence agencies. And so today, you know, Vlad, maybe a little bit sad. Especially as this isn't the first attempt on Zelensky's life by Russia. Right, with some of the most notable being, like, in April of this year, a Polish man was picked up by Polish police for working on a plot against Ukraine's president. And back in 2023, a Ukrainian woman down south was arrested after she was caught red-handed trying to pass off information about Zelensky's visit to a city there so Russia could hit him with an airstrike. Though, of course, the most infamous attempt was during the initial invasion, where Russia actually tried to land paratroopers into Kyiv to kill Zelensky, which I was actually surprised to find this is historically not normal. Targeting foreign leaders during a war is pretty unheard of outside of extreme cases like trying to kill Hitler, which if you think about it, does actually make sense, right? It opens up Pandora's box of assassination attempts after assassination attempts. But seemingly here, this is something very much on the table, so we'll have to see how all this plays out.
And then
it has been a whirlwind couple of days when it comes to news on Israel and Gaza. But some of the biggest news today is that the Israeli military has entered Rafah and taken control of its border crossing with Egypt. And a key takeaway here is that according to the New York Times, this offensive doesn't appear to be a full ground invasion. Instead, it's reportedly aimed at specifically destroying Hamas fighters and infrastructure in Rafah that were used in an attack that killed four Israeli soldiers over the weekend. Though with that, the Israeli defense minister vowed just this morning that the operation in Rafah will not stop until Hamas is eliminated in the area or the first hostage returns to Israel. And so far, as of recording, Israeli strikes across Rafah have reportedly killed at least 23 Palestinians, including at least 6 women and 5 children. Though notably, the humanitarian fallout from this operation has the potential to be far more deadly. Right, and a lot of that has to do with that border crossing that Israeli forces have taken control of. You know, you have the Israeli military claiming they did that after receiving intelligence it was, quote, being used for terrorist purposes, and specifically alleging that the area around the crossing was used to launch the attack this weekend that killed four Israeli soldiers near the Kerem Shalom border crossing, with that attack also leading to the closure of that border crossing. And another key thing is that this latest offensive has now led to the closure of the Rafah border crossing as well. And that's absolutely huge, as these are the two main points of entry for humanitarian aid into Gaza. Or in the words of the spokesperson for the UN Humanitarian Office, Israel has choked off the two main arteries for getting aid into Gaza, with them also noting that if fuel is not able to enter, it would, quote, be a very effective way of putting the humanitarian operation in its grave. And in fact, as the Rafah offensive was beginning this morning, UNRWA warned that the catastrophic hunger faced by people, especially in northern Gaza, will get much worse if these supply routes are interrupted. And this is the head of the UN has previously warned that an entirely preventable human-made famine is imminent in northern Gaza. And of course, some additional context to keep in mind here is that the Israeli government, and even in some cases, Israeli citizens, have been criticized for blocking access to aid in Gaza for almost the entirety of this war, with aid groups and foreign diplomats accusing Israeli forces of arbitrarily turning away aid and systematically limiting deliveries, with UN officials also noting that over 200 aid workers have been killed in Gaza during war. And now today, we're also seeing reports that the so-called safe zone that Israel had told Gazans and Rafah to flee to, that is neither safe nor equipped to receive them. Right, and that's coming from both UN and European officials who are warning that Israel's order to evacuate parts of the city yesterday may amount to a war crime. Also, another aspect of this whole situation is, you know, as we're seeing this offensive underway, right, that is playing out as reportedly there is a ceasefire deal on the table and Israeli negotiators are back in Cairo. Right, because like we talked about yesterday, Hamas has accepted a Qatari-Egyptian proposal for a ceasefire. Though really, we later learned that it was more that they put forward a counter-offer to an earlier Israeli proposal, but then the Israeli government responding by saying that proposal was far from meeting Israel's core demands. But still with that, saying they would send a delegation to Egypt in an effort to, quote, maximize the possibility of reaching an agreement on terms acceptable to Israel. With, of course, a big part of that being saying that Israel would still continue its operation in Rafah, with reportedly the aim being to apply military pressure to Hamas to advance the release of hostages and achieve the other objectives of the war. Though with that, you have experts saying that the Israeli assault in Rafah could drive ceasefire talks in one of two directions. Right? It could increase pressure on Hamas to make a deal, or it could make Hamas even less inclined to negotiate. And while at this point it seems like both sides are willing to an agreement that would include a first phase ceasefire and hostage release, critically, they still agree on the most fundamental question, whether an agreement would actually put a permanent end to the war. You know, because permanent versus temporary ceasefire, that's a pretty big divide. And also a thing to consider as all of this is playing out is that Netanyahu may also be thinking about his own political survival. Because we've actually seen thousands of Israelis around the country joining rallies calling for Netanyahu to agree to the terms Hamas proposed yesterday. But at the same time, some have speculated that he faces more pressure from right-wing members of his government to keep the war going, with a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute telling the Times that Netanyahu needs the Rafah operation to remain in power and to appease the fanatics in his coalition, and adding there that Netanyahu himself has little to gain from a ceasefire deal and a lot to lose. Though all of this playing out as other experts are saying that Netanyahu might be trying to find a balance between both sides, right? Especially as you have the United States and Biden repeatedly warning Netanyahu against a full-scale assault on Rafah, right? Notably, all of that as Biden himself is trying to do his own balancing act. But for now, everything is still developing. It's all happening in real time, and we'll have to wait to see what happens from here. But in the meantime, of course, I'd love to know your thoughts.
And then,
you know, heart disease is no joke. And like most families, it runs in mine. You know, throughout my own personal journey these past years, I've been doing all the things that we're told to do, from changing my diet to adding in more cardio. But these are good things. They are big changes that can be hard to maintain at the level needed in order to make a difference. And then recently, I found out about the fantastic sponsor of today's show, Super Beats Heart Chews. Not only are Super Beats the number one doctor, pharmacist, and cardiologist recommended beat brand for cardiovascular health support, they have over 100,000 five-star reviews, which, I mean, that's 100,000. That's saying something. And with just two tasty chews a day, that I'm not kidding, they taste good. You get your daily blood pressure support while promoting heart-healthy energy without the stimulants. Paired with a healthy lifestyle, the antioxidants in Superbeats are clinically shown to be nearly 2 times more effective at promoting normal blood pressure than a healthy lifestyle alone. And Superbeet chews make it easier for me to confidently maintain heart health matters, especially since they're so small and I can take them on the go. I mean, it really couldn't be easier. So double your potential with Superbeets Heart Chews. Get a free 30-day supply of Superbeets Heart Chews on all bundles and 15% off your first order by going to GetSuperBeets.com and use code DeFranco. That's GetSuperBeets.com. Code DeFranco.
And then,
so I've got some good news and some bad news for you. The bad news is sometimes roughly between your 40s and your 60s, the lenses in your eyeballs, they're going to stiffen, making you farsighted. Right? It's a condition known as presbyopia, and everyone eventually gets it. You, me, someone you like, someone you hate. Time is the great equalizer. And presbyopia accounts for the vast majority of preventable or untreated vision impairments worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. But the good news is that you can easily fix it with a pair of over-the-counter reading glasses, but only if you have access to said counter and money to buy them in the first place. And sadly, nearly a billion people in the developing world can't take that for granted, which is why over 90% of people with untreated presbyopia live in lower middle-income countries. And within sub-Saharan Africa, more than 8 in 10 people with the condition go untreated. To which I know, some people might say, so what, Phil? Yeah, it sucks. But like, blurry vision's gotta be at the bottom of the list of problems for these parts of the world, especially compared to infectious diseases like tuberculosis, malaria, and AIDS that are still out of control. But to that, I would say, one, just because other problems exist doesn't mean this one's less important. Especially because, two, yeah, it turns out fucked up eyeballs kill people too. Right? People with poor central visual acuity are almost 50% more likely to have a road accident crash, according to The Lancet. And in poor countries where untreated impairments are more common and drivers often obtain a license without undergoing a vision test, those traffic deaths make up more than 90% of the world's total. And that's even though those countries account for only 60% of cars. Right? So we can make a strong guess that simple vision problems may indirectly kill tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people each year. But also, while fatalities are important, the issue is so much bigger than that. Right? For example, young children can have a harder time getting an education, which affects them for the rest of their lives. With the global director of Our Children's Vision, a nonprofit that supplies eyeglasses in Africa, telling the New York Times, many of these kids are classified as poor learners or just dumb and therefore don't progress at school. But then even for people listed as uneducated farmers, the disability takes a toll. With, for example, the outlet talking to an Indian sharecropper who couldn't spot pests on his wheat crops and accidentally sprayed the wrong insecticide because he misread the label. As well as other examples like coffee farmers in Bolivia who couldn't tell which beans were ripe. And, you know, it's not just inconvenient, it's detrimental. Right? According to the World Health Organization, the world loses a projected $400 billion in potential productivity every year because of vision impairment. And that despite there being a surprisingly easy fix. With The Lancet reporting that simply giving Indian tea pickers reading glasses made them 22% more productive. And for those over the age age of 50, that number jumped to nearly 32%, which brings us to the most recent study that shows how these gains translate into cold, hard cash. Because if we can't appeal to people's hearts, why not their wallets? Right, because we saw researchers picking out a group of over 800 far-sighted tea pickers, weavers, seamstresses, and others between the ages of 35 and 65 in Bangladesh. They then gave half of them free reading glasses. What a shitty time to be a part of the control group. But when they followed up 8 months later, the ones with glasses were making 33% more money than the ones without. And some people who were previously unemployed, they found work. And all of this, even though barely more than a third of them were literate. Because even if you can't read, reading glasses also make it easier to thread needles and stitch clothing, for example. Which is also why one tailor even called the glasses his lifeline and said that they caused his income to double. With other research also noting how presbyopia makes basic things like cooking, using a phone, or recognizing money more difficult. And in many villages, the benefits can be social as well as economic for women in particular. With a Bangladesh country director for Vision Spring, a nonprofit that took part in the study, explaining to the Times, when it takes longer to sew and clean, or you can't pick out all the stones from the rice, in some households it results in domestic violence. Though of course, there specifically, eyeglasses are more of a band-aid fix than actually addressing the deeper problem. But social and economic impacts aside, improving people's eyesight also improves their quality of life. With, for example, the Times describing how a 12-year-old boy in India had to give up flying kites, then cricket, and then his dreams of becoming a pilot, and adding that his constant squinting gave him headaches and he dreaded walking home for fear of being hit by traffic. And all of that as the World Health Organization notes that adults with vision impairment can suffer higher rates of depression and anxiety. And for older adults, they're more likely to experience social isolation as well as falls and fractures. Which also, just to be clear, this is not to say that people with low vision or no vision, they can't live life to the fullest. Right? And I also want to preface, the following words are not from me, they are from Chris on my team. Take it from the blind guy that's working on this story with me. They certainly can. Chris is out here trying to get me canceled. But, you know, he said we can still work within the limits of what different people's bodies can do to maximize their functionality. And in that respect, the right pair of glasses can be as life-changing for a low vision person as a good cane, screen reader, or other assistive tech are for a totally blind person. And notably, compared to the typical public health problems policymakers usually focus on in poor countries, addressing presbyopia is exceptionally cheap and easy. It actually takes very little training to get community workers to do fittings for new eyeglass customers, and a single pair can cost only a couple of dollars to produce, sometimes even as low as 50 cents depending on the factory. And so the World Health Organization estimates it would only cost around $25 billion to fill the gap of unmet vision impairment needs globally. Which again, to appeal to people's wallets, that's pennies on the dollar compared to the $400 billion in productivity losses I mentioned earlier. Which remember, that is per year. But because of a lack of resources and a general unawareness about the issue, governments and philanthropists devote almost no money to it. Plus, poor countries tend to regulate the market much more strictly than we do in the US and Europe. So whereas you and I in the developed world can just go pick up a pair of reading glasses at the drugstore, people elsewhere have to first get a prescription from a vision specialist who may not even be available in certain regions. And as many populations around the world grow older and older, the need for basic eye care services and products will only increase. And so with all that said, I'm going to put links of one of the orgs I mentioned, Vision Spring, down below in case you feel compelled to donate. But also, with everyone, I'd love to know your thoughts on this. Because in retrospect, it's so obvious that this would be such a widespread problem, but it was very eye-opening to learn about. And then, finally, today we have commentary, where we calm things down a little bit, we shoot the shit like friends, and we also dive into the comments in yesterday's show and talk about it. Which I will say, on a personal note, I want to apologize to my my friends and family today. It has come to my attention that the early access version of Hades 2 is now officially out, and I will be choosing that and myself over you for the next day or so, at least. Which, by the way, if you've never played the first one, best roguelike I've ever played. And the thing that really sealed the deal for me playing this early access rather than waiting is that apparently the save files will transfer. But that's where I'm going to stop there because I'm getting too nerdy. The last personal thing, and it's more an offer if you want to join me, if you're looking for a little spark, sometimes you just need that nudge for a first step. My buddy and I, Devin, started doing a daily 100 challenge. Every day you do 100 push-ups, 100 sit-ups, 100 squats. You finish with like a 2-minute plank. And you can split them however you want. Like I do 4 sets of 25. Right? If you're completely out of shape, you could do 20 sets of 5. Starting on your knees. We then send each other a text to say, hey, I did it. Fucko, did you do it? This is mine from yesterday, which is just day 3. And so if you want to join in on the daily 100, just start with us today. I'm gonna be annoying. I'm gonna start posting it to my Instagram story. Also, I will say, when I told some people about this yesterday, they were like, you know, that already is a thing. It's the One Punch Man challenge. But I looked into it, and that apparently is also you run 10 kilometers a day, and fuck that. Granted, yesterday I also did an 8-mile hike, but I'm not running 10 kilometers a day. My knees will explode. Anyway, let's jump into those comments. Starting with most of the commentary around the Drake Kendrick stuff being people just talking about their favorite lines. With Navit saying the line, why you trolling like a bitch? Ain't you tired? Trying to strike a chord, and it's probably a minor. Has to be the most diabolical shit ever. With Maggie Pop saying, my 6th graders were talking about this today. Crazy. Which actually, with that, yesterday I saw saw this really interesting video. And it was this teacher talking about how when she went into school this week, seeing how her students were talking about the Drake versus Kendrick Lamar situation was so eye-opening.
I, up until today, taught at a very Drake-centric high school. Rich Baby Daddy is the most frequently requested song to put on my class playlist. If I ask students what they're listening to in their headphones, Drake. The week after the leak was a nightmare. But today I walk in and I can feel that there has been a tectonic shift. The second I walked into the building, I could hear the buzz. I could kind of overhear the conversations. And I was like, oh my God, this is a Kendrick school now. I polled my classes on what they thought and they were ready to throw down for Kendrick. I had like one Drake defender in each class, if that. And honestly, I feel bad for those kids because they were getting screamed at. I had a kid walk into class, phone over his head, blasting BBL Drizzy. And then he went up to his friends and got them to freestyle on it. Like, excuse me? This was a Drake high school. I have students who hate reading who are doing the most meticulous, close reading of these lyrics that I have ever seen.
But then also, as far as a heavier conversation, there was a lot of talk about the pastor's wife who died. With some like Kendo Landon saying, if that pastor didn't murder Micah, I'll be incredibly shocked. Like, yes, he's innocent until proven guilty, but that last bit about having video evidence of her having suicidal ideation and announcing to his congregation she unalived herself before the cops determined what the cause was, it reeks of trying to get ahead of the story. There were also comments like that from Nico, who claimed, I worked with Micah. She was a server at a local chain. She was the salt of the earth, and I hope she sees justice. The whole community here is pretty up in arms about it, which is good, but adding, without the media attention, this would have been swept under the rug. And others like Mr. Miss Shuffle saying, I know a woman who is the wife of a Baptist preacher. Before he died, you would have thought they were the perfect God-fearing family. I went to school with their son. Well, find out years later, after the son of a bitch died, he was beating her within an inch of her life. It wouldn't be outside of the realm of possibility that that preacher killed his wife and is using her past of mental illness to cover his tracks. But that is where your Tuesday evening, Wednesday morning show is gonna end. But don't worry about missing my dumb face and voice, because remember, my name's Philip DeFranco. You've just been filled in. I love yo faces, and I'll see you right back here tomorrow for more news. You on my mind a lot, don't need no time watch. I don't know how I got you in my pocket spot. Yeah, this babe, need you every day. You light my oxygen.